Hi, you're tuned to the Channel of Truth, Truth News Radio Australia, coming to you on this fourth day of December 2013. It's a great pleasure to be bringing you this show today, and I do have a lot of material that I need to go with you in the next 2 hours. I have an excellent interview coming up in the second hour, so I do hope you stay with us. I have a filmmaker and activist, Harry Fear, coming on, joining us from the UK, to talk about his work and research in Gaza and the occupied territories in Palestine. And he has a really strong grasp of the situation and the geopolitical realities in that region. So that's going to be a very, very important look into what is actually happening in that part of the world. And we haven't done anything on that for a while. In the first hour, I've got a lot of material to get through with you today. I'm going to be talking quite a lot about the unfolding crisis in Thailand with the massive protest movement that has been building and building, and it has now reached the stage where the protesters in the centre of Bangkok have occupied many government buildings, and the government has really backed down, largely because they really have so little support. I'm actually currently in Thailand, so I've been putting quite a lot of work into this subject, and I've been posting quite a lot about it on my Facebook page for those who follow that. I'm going to read to you today from some articles written by Tony Cartolucci, who writes for a site, altthainews.blogspot.com, which I highly recommend to you as a source of accurate news reporting on what is going on in Thailand, because the media cartels, the corporate media, is giving you the most biased and ridiculous picture of what is actually happening in Thailand. And of course, you know, we're all used to that. We know the news lies. We know the BBC doesn't tell it like it is. But there are times when it's just so ridiculous and so far from reality that it beggars the imagination to see these news organizations acting in this way, really acting as propagandists and, you know, agencies for disinformation and propaganda to steer public opinion around the world. And you might ask, why would they want to do that? Why would these major news agencies be so concerned about directing your opinion about what's happening in some far-flung place like Thailand? Well, there's very good reasons why they do, folks, and it's part of what we're going to be talking to you about in today's show, so stay tuned for that. I also am going to bring you a clip of Noam Chomsky talking about 9/11 conspiracy theories. This is another subject that I've been following a lot lately, the subject of Noam Chomsky and his 9/11 views, which have been popping up on YouTube. And I just think for our listeners, I'd like to provide to you a glimpse of what this very famous, iconic man, Chomsky, has been saying, for you to understand how it is that someone who has such respect, who has done very good critiques of the world and politics and conflicts in the past, could be so childish and simplistic in relation to very important questions about what really happened on 9/11. So I'll play to you some of that clip during today's show. And I'm also going to be playing to you a clip from Harry Fear talking at a TEDx conference. And Harry Fear is the guest I have lined up in the second hour. So settle in and get yourself a nice mug of coffee and settle down for a really interesting barrage of information. Okay, first let's talk about Thailand. Now, a bit of context here. Thailand, for those who aren't aware, Thailand is a kingdom, and the king in Thailand is treated with extreme reverence. The kings of Thailand are greatly respected by the people. And this actually goes back over a century to kind of a tradition within the monarchy of Thailand of the kings being quite enlightened and instituting a lot of reforms in the interests of the people, bringing in free education and free health care and handing over a lot of lands to the people. The king in Thailand does not involve himself in policy and appears to be a symbolic role, but a very, very important one, and has the current king has been very important in times of crisis in Thailand, and indeed at the present is in probably one of the most serious crises that Thailand has ever had. And as we go to air today, it is actually the king's birthday, and you will be seeing in Thailand a calming of the situation because of the general respect for the king, and the king will be giving an address on live television on the 5th of December. So now, just to recap, for those who don't know what the current crisis is, the current government is led by a lady by the name of Yingluck Shinawatra, and she is actually the sister of the ousted former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, who was the Prime Minister from 2001 to 2006. The former Prime Minister has been accused and convicted on numerous charges of corruption and also charges of what they call a lèse majesté, which is offending the king, which is very, very serious in Thailand. He's seen by most Thais as being a crook, a criminal, and Thai people feel it is outrageous that he was allowed to go free at all. But not only was he allowed to go free, he was allowed to leave the country, but with his vast wealth, because this man is a billionaire, with his vast wealth, he was able to reinvigorate the political party which he previously led, and by pumping money in through proxies into the country, he was able to create a political movement which was known as the Red Shirts, which led to an occupation of the capital, Bangkok, in 2010, and led to the military coming out once again, as they had previously, to break that up and restore order. And again, I should point out that the military in Thailand, the military came out and actually were responsible for removing Thaksin Shinawatra from power. They came out again when the Red Shirts had occupied Bangkok. And a lot of people see that as a bad thing. And they say, well, military coups are a bad thing. When the military takes over a country, they see it as a bad thing. And in many cases, that's correct. But you cannot assume that as a blanket assumption. You really do have to look at the individual cases. And in the case of Thailand, the way the Thai people see it is certainly not that. And really, if you look at it, it appears that the military in Thailand have acted at the behest of the popular will. You could compare it in some ways to what happened in Egypt recently with the overthrow of the Morsi government, which again has been depicted in the West as a military coup and therefore a bad thing. But the Egyptian people have said, you know, within the millions, that that was what they wanted, that it was in fact a continuation of the Arab Spring and the movement towards democracy. And that indeed is what people are saying in Thailand as well. Again, with the current protest movement, which is trying to unseat the current government. Now, let's talk a little about the current government. The current government, led by Yingluck Shinawatra, the sister of the ousted and convicted former leader. And it's been admitted that she actually takes orders from her brother, and that she is therefore acting more or less as a proxy for this greatly reviled man. Bigger picture here of the current regime and what its connections are to geopolitics and the rest of the world. The the Chinoise regime has had a very, very cozy relationship with the United States. It has engaged in trying to make free trade agreements, which many Thais objected to because it would erode their sovereignty and steal their assets. The previous government was involved in quite brutal military exercises. They were also allied very strongly with the US war on terror, renditions, and the invasion of Iraq, all of which is greatly opposed by many, many Thai people. The movement now was triggered into its current state by a bill which was put forward in the parliament in Thailand for an amnesty, which would have completely whitewashed the crimes of the former leader and allowed him to come back into the country without going to jail. And that was the final straw. That was what pushed this over the line into a massive movement. Now, that's enough of my background. I'm going to read to you a little from a few articles here by Tony Cartolucci, who writes for Alt Thai News. The current government of Thailand is being openly run by a convicted criminal, Thaksin Shinawatra, who is hiding abroad and running the country through his sister Yingluck Shinawatra and his vast political machine, the Pua Thai Party, PTP. PTP is augmented by street mobs donning bright red shirts, earning them the title the Red Shirts, as well as a myriad of foreign-funded NGOs and propaganda fronts. While it would seem like an open and shut case regarding the illegitimacy of the current government, Western nations have urged protesters to observe the rule of law and have condemned protesters taking over government ministry buildings. Why is the West now seemingly defending the current Thai government after nearly 3 years of backing protests around the world against other governments it claimed were overtly corrupt and despotic? It's very simple. Unlike in Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, Russia, Yemen, Libya, Malaysia, and elsewhere, where the West has backed protests, the current government in Thailand is a creation of and a servant to the corporate financier interests of Wall Street and London. Regardless of the cartoonish nepotism of a nation run by the sister of an ousted dictator, media in the West continues to portray the current Thai government as legitimate, elected, and democratic. Thaksin Shinawatra's egregious crimes while in office are buried in articles, or worse yet, never mentioned at all. And you are listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm talking about the situation and crisis in Thailand. It is a great pleasure to be with you today, and I'll be right back after this very short break. Stay with us.
Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio, and you can find us at www.truthnews.com.au, and I do encourage you very strongly to find us there, because you'll see a lot more material, and you'll be able to check out our Facebook page and join the community of followers if you're interested in what we do, or if you're Australian, or if you just like the information you find. You're most welcome to send us a line and send us some tips if you've got anything interesting you would like to have discussed on the show. Now, I'll just continue here reading from the article by Tony Cartolucci about the Thai situation. And while I do so, bear in mind this was written more than a week ago, before the protests got anywhere near as big as they are now. Before the protests get any bigger and the conflict more widespread, readers may want to ask and have answered the following questions. 1. Who really leads Thailand's current government? Thaksin had been Prime Minister from 2001 to 2006. Long before Thaksin Shinawatra would become Prime Minister in Thailand, he was already working his way up the Wall Street, London ladder of opportunity, while simultaneously working his way up in Thai politics. He was appointed by the Carlyle Group as an advisor while holding public office and attempted to use his connections to boost his political image. Thanong Kantong of Thailand's English newspaper The Nation wrote in 2001, "In April 1998, while Thailand was still mired in deep economic morass, Thaksin tried to use his American connections to boost his political image, just as he was forming his Thai Rak Thai party. He invited Bush Sr. to visit Bangkok and his home, saying his own mission was to act as a national matchmaker between the US equity fund and Thai businesses. He also played host to James Baker III, the US Secretary of State in the senior Bush administration, on his sojourn in Thailand. Upon becoming Prime Minister in 2001, Thaksin would begin paying back the support he received from his Western sponsors. In 2003, he would commit Thai troops to the US invasion of Iraq, despite widespread protests from both the Thai military and the public. Thaksin would also allow the CIA to use Thailand for its abhorrent rendition program. Also, in 2003, starting in February and over the course of 3 months, some 2,800 people, approximately 30 per day, would be extrajudicially murdered in the cities and countrysides of Thailand as part of Thaksin's war on drugs. Accused of being drug dealers, victims were systematically exterminated based on hit lists compiled by police who were given carte blanche by Thaksin. It would later be determined by official investigations that over half of those killed had nothing to do with the drug trade in any way. Human Rights Watch would confirm this in their 2008 report titled Thailand's War on Drugs. In 2004, Thaksin attempted to ramrod through a US-Thailand free trade agreement without parliamentary approval, backed by US ASEAN Business Council, who just before the 2011 elections that saw Thaksin's sister brought into power, hosted the leaders of Thaksin's Red Shirt United Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship. The council in 2004 included 3M, Bechtel, Boeing, Cargill, Citigroup, General Electric, IBM, Monsanto, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Chevron, Exxon. Goodness me, it's a long list. And this indeed was the council that was supporting and backing Thaksin Shinawatra's political resurgence through the Red Shirt movement. Thaksin would remain in office until September of 2006. On the eve of the military coup that ousted him from power, Thaksin was literally standing before the Fortune 500-funded Council on Foreign Relations, giving a progress report in New York City. Since the 2006 coup that toppled his regime, Thaksin has been represented by US corporate financier elites by their lobbying firms. And there's a long list of them here, which I won't go through. Let's just move forward here. Question number two. How did Thaksin Shinawatra get back into power? Almost as soon as Thaksin was ousted from power in 2006, both his political party in Thailand and his Western backers abroad began a campaign to demonize and destroy the Thai establishment. A myriad of loaded news stories and op-eds in habitually biased publications, including The Economist, Time and Newsweek, targeted Thailand for what was called a slide backwards from democracy, all while Thaksin was praised for his policies aimed at Thailand's marginalized poor. Beginning in 2009, Thaksin's political front began a campaign of increasingly violent confrontations with the prevailing Thai establishment. During April of 2009, protests staged by Thaksin's UDD red shirts would leave widespread property damage and two dead bystanders gunned down while trying to defend their property from looting protesters. In 2010, intent on generating enough domestic and international outrage to topple the Thai establishment, some 300 covert militants were brought in to trigger deadly violence that would last weeks, turning parts of Thailand's capital, Bangkok, into a war zone. Over 90 people would die, including soldiers, police, innocent bystanders, as well as protesters themselves, cut down by crossfire between militants and soldiers and smoke inhalation while looting buildings fellow protesters had lit ablaze. While the Thai military succeeded in restoring order across the city, Thaksin and his Western backers had the momentum they needed to continue radicalizing the UDD redshirts, as well as turning international opinion against Thailand. Running on a campaign of promising cheap houses and cars, free computers, and the eradication of both flooding and droughts, as well as guaranteed prices for rice grown by Thailand's many rice farmers, the poor Thai party easily won yet another election, providing a perfect example of how Western-backed client regimes are more than glad to use populism to co-opt large segments of a targeted nation's population, if national leaders themselves are not willing to first. With an accused mass murderer, a convicted criminal, hiding abroad to evade multiple arrest warrants, openly running the government through his own sister, and none of his poor Thai campaign promises being kept after over 2 years in power, Thailand's establishment may feel the timing is right to begin to apply pressure that will ultimately oust Thaksin from power once again, and perhaps once and for all. So who are the anti-regime protesters in Thailand? And I'm going to read to you here from another article by the same author, Tony Cartolucci, which was written just yesterday. After clashes with police in Bangkok and the taking of several government buildings, anti-regime protesters prepared for the next phase of their resistance, the protracted encampment of key governmental centres. Thousands of protesters are now permanently entrenched in an area widening for nearly a mile through the capital city. They have built a city within a city at three main locations that are linked by the constant stream of protesters coming and going from the protest sites. So who are the protesters and what do they want? Are they, as the Western media portrays them, anti-democratic elitists who refuse to concede power to awakened rural masses? And I will continue with that when we return from the break. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. It's a great pleasure talking to you today. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm going to continue reading now from this article by Tony Cartalucci talking about the situation in Thailand. And we've just reached the question about who are these protesters and what do they want? Are they, as Western media portrays them, anti-democratic elitists who refuse to concede power to awakened rural masses? Or are they dangerously informed, socially and politically aware groups that are actively opposing the designs of foreign corporate financiers and the proxy regime they have put into power in Thailand? Walking from one end of the protest to the other can be an all-day affair. The sites are spaced out, but occupy long stretches of road turned into permanent encampments, complete with food, water, medical services, bathrooms, and shower stalls. There are thousands of permanently encamped protesters and thousands more who come and go. The extensive infrastructure of these protest sites resembles a fair or an exhibition. While a single theme has brought them together, a large number of diverse groups have marshalled their resources to build the sprawling encampments. And there are a number of groups that have set up at these encampments, including the main opposition party, the Democrats, the People's Democratic Reform Committee, and the Network of Students and People for Reform of Thailand. The Yellow Shirt People's Alliance for Democracy also maintains a camp, as does Santa Asoke, a group that practices the Thai equivalent of organic farming. There are, throughout the camps, smaller student groups from across Bangkok and a number of large labour unions. What do they want? We are told by the Western media that this is a people's coup, an attempt to overthrow democracy. In reality, and entirely unlike Thaksin's red shirts who simplistically demand democracy, the anti-regime protesters have a list of cogent demands. First one being no amnesty. This refers to the amnesty bill designed by and for Thaksin Shinawatra to absolve himself of a decade of plundering, lying, and mass murder. Number two, rollback of Article 190. And I think this is actually very important, this second demand here. Article 190 of the Thai Constitution requires that all treaties be approved by the Parliament before they can be signed. In 2004, this mechanism had prevented Thaksin Shinawatra from unilaterally passing a US-Thai free trade agreement and was one of the many attempted circumventions of the law that led to his ouster in 2006. His nepotist-appointed sister Yingluck Shinawatra has now managed to amend it, making it possible for her to unilaterally approve treaties. Point number three, again extremely important, the renationalisation of Thailand's oil. Thailand's oil giant, PTT, was privatised and sold off to foreign multinationals under Thaksin Shinawatra in late 2001. Tremendous wealth has been siphoned out of Thailand and sent overseas, particularly to Chevron, one of the many sponsors on the US-ASEAN Business Council that directly supports the Shinawatra regime. Point number four, again, extremely important, keep Thailand anti-GMO. The current Thai establishment, resisting the regime, has been stalwartly defending against GMO and intellectual property laws pushed on them by the United States, the UK, and the EU. In fact, one of the main points of attack by Thaksin Shinawatra's Washington lobbyists was attacking the military council that ousted Thaksin for ignoring US pharmaceutical patents while producing cheaper drugs for poorer patients. Regarding GMO, Monsanto has been desperately trying to overrun Thailand's food security, but to no avail. Would it surprise readers to know that the US-ASEAN Business Council directly supporting Thaksin Shinawatra and his political machine also includes Monsanto? So as you can see, folks, there are some really, really powerful global forces of which we're all very familiar that are involved in this current situation in Thailand. And as he says here, it becomes abundantly clear why corporate media houses like the BBC, Reuters AP, CNN, etc., and Australia's ABC have attacked the protesters as anti-democratic, elitist, and violent. They represent, for them, a population they cannot trick, manipulate, and have their way with. They would like to see it marginalized and removed from Thailand's political landscape so they can grind Thailand into the ground like so many other nations across the developing world. Thailand's anti-regime protesters are making their stand. Those that support true freedom and progress should stand with them. And now for something completely different. As I promised earlier, I'm going to play to you a clip of Noam Chomsky discussing 9/11 conspiracy theorists. And this was quite a surprise to me. Many of you may have heard this already. The clip from YouTube is a couple of years old. But it adds to the list of bizarre statements, incredibly simplistic statements that have been made by Noam Chomsky on the question of 9/11. And it really does make one wonder what makes this man tick. But without further ado, I will play to you now a clip of Noam Chomsky talking about 9/11 conspiracy theorists.
Story. The 9/11 one is pretty interesting, actually. It's a huge part of the country. I mean, I think it's like maybe a third of the population or half the population. The activists in it, the people in the center of it, as far as I can tell, very few of them are people with any record or involvement in political activism, you know, doing anything. I mean, maybe a couple here and there. Most of them are just drawn into it. And, you know, and they have factoids too. Like somebody found the nanothermite, whatever the hell that is, in the bottom of Building 7 or whatever. Okay. I have no idea what it means or if it means anything. But that's the core of a large part of the evidence that was done by the Bush administration. Now, the people who are writing about this, they are experts in physics and civil engineering on the basis of an hour on the internet. Okay, so you spend an hour on the internet, you become a super expert in civil engineering and physics, and you learn what nanothermite is, and you know, and so on. And it's kind of like, I mean, you know, I don't have to tell you what it takes to understand something about physics. It's not an hour on the internet. They've managed to collect a very small scattering of architects and, you know, one or two people who are supposed to be scientists and a couple of others who write articles in the Journal of 9/11 Studies and maybe sometimes in an online journal somewhere.
Just pause there. Now, I'm going to play to you another clip in a moment where he continues on this theme of what he calls a minuscule number of architects and engineers, and whereas in fact it's over 2,000. And I just want to comment on his kind of faux ignorance that he claims there when he says, oh, there was an article about thermite and I don't know anything about that. You know, you look at the man, you look at the body language there and what he's saying, and you have to say this is not genuine. I would love to believe that it is genuine, that it's simply that he doesn't get it or he's ignorant, but I think a better explanation of what's going on here is that he is actually engaging in a little bit of spin, a little bit of propaganda, and he's steering his listeners and his supporters, you know, his many, many supporters, steering them away from this topic. He's just saying, no, we'll not consider this. He's taking this imperious role that many great men, many icons, many sort of cult leaders do in basically controlling people's thinking. And I'm going to play to you another clip now, which is even more egregious in that respect. And this clip is much more recent. It's from October 2013, and it features Bob Tuskin asking Noam Chomsky a question at the end of one of his speeches. Actually, we are going to have to go to break now. I will bring that to you when we come back from break. This is a clip that focuses on questioning Chomsky about his belief in relation to Building 7, and he's certainly seen the information. He knows about the collapse of Building 7. Very, very interesting response there that he gives to this questioner. We'll be right back after this break. Please don't go away. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm playing to you here some clips from Noam Chomsky expressing his strange lack of comprehension of the many, many questions and fairly obvious concerns that many, many highly intelligent people have about the official story of 9/11. And this particular one I'm going to play to you now is a clip of an activist, Bob Tuscan, who questioned Chomsky at a recent lecture in Florida, specifically about the collapse of Building 7.
All right. Noam, thanks for coming. You've mentioned quite a few contradictions from the media and their presentation on things. And I think the most notorious case of this is with September 11th, 2001. You mentioned in a forum on ZNet in 2006 that you wanted to see a consensus of engineers and specialists that understand the actual structures of these buildings and their possible collapse. And there is such a group, and I'm here to tell you about that and ask you a follow-up question. It's called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There's a consensus of over 2,000 of them.
All right, is this a question or
please don't interrupt. I'm asking a question. I'm setting it up. Thank you. This consensus shows that Building 7, the third building that fell on 9/11, fell in free fall speed, as this report acknowledges. Are you ready to come forward and jump on board with 9/11? I know you've mentioned it's a distraction, but there's no better case of the media covering up things than not presenting Building 7, that third building. We've all seen the other towers fall, but what about Building 7, Noam?
Well, in fact, you're right that there's a consensus among a minuscule number of architects and engineers, tiny number.
Let's just pause it there again. Again, he's using this this technique of what is really a complete fallacy. He's using the argument from consensus fallacy to say that there is no consensus. He's saying that there is a minuscule number, therefore what? I mean, he's basically pouring cold water on it using this argument that it is a minuscule number. Now, in fact, 2,000 is not a minuscule number. 2,000 qualified and rigorously checked, I might add, members of an organization. It's not easy to join Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. They go through and they do check your academic requirements, and I've had that confirmed to me by people who are members of that and are qualified engineers. So there's two things going on here. Firstly, he's putting forward a fallacy as an argument. Secondly, he's spinning a furphy when he says it's a minuscule number. And notice he doesn't tell you what the number really is. He just says it's minuscule. What does that mean? Well, I don't think 2,000 is minuscule, do you? So let's just continue now, and we'll play to you a little more of this clip from Noam Chomsky.
A couple of them are perfectly serious. They are not doing what scientists and engineers do when they think they've discovered something. What you do when you think you've discovered something, what you do is write articles in scientific journals, give talks at the professional societies, go to the civil engineering department at MIT or Florida or wherever you are, and present your results.
Pause it there again. Again, he's actually advancing two fallacies in one statement. It's quite interesting. He does this double barrel thing with dishonest statements. Firstly, a key group within Architects and Engineers, led by Richard Gage, did author a scientific journal article, and they did go through the correct academic procedure and publish it in a peer-reviewed scientific journal. And this is the article about nanothermite. So that has already been done. Secondly, he talks about, you go and you present it here and you present it there and you approach this or that organization. He knows full well that this is essentially very, very inflammatory, controversial, dissident material. And in a regime where questioning the official views of things is seen as a threat, he knows all too well from his very, very long career of studying tyranny all around the world that you simply cannot do that and that you will be silenced. It's childish, really, what he is doing here. It really is quite amazing. I'm quite baffled by it. Now, unfortunately, I am running out of time. I'm not able to bring you any more of that speech by Noam Chomsky, but I'll put it on the show notes and you can certainly check it out. I want to play to you now the clip from Harry Fear, my guest, who's joining us in the second hour that I mentioned earlier, speaking at the TEDx conference this year. And he says some really interesting things about the media, and I'll only have a chance to play a few minutes of it, but I think you'll find it quite interesting. So this is Harry Fear, and the title of the speech is Challenging Realities, the Mainstream Media and You, TEDx Copenhagen. 2013.
Hello. Hello, thank you. Thank you in advance for your attention. As a kid, I was horrified when my country went to war with Iraq in 2003. But I was also horrified about the mainstream media coverage we saw. I didn't see the horror of war that I knew instinctively existed. I was deeply affected by the injustice I felt, as I know many others were. Particularly since the US-led coalition invasion of Iraq in 2003, the mainstream media is less and less trusted, and for very good reason, and no less by me. The mainstream media often presents to us a cozy world view. It often abrogates us individuals of our shared moral responsibilities. When we turn on the news, we are so often presented with what famously British playwright Harold Pinter famously called a vast tapestry of lies upon which we feed. Put alternatively, when we turn on the news, we're often presented with an image of reality that is lacking in depth, clarity, and humanity. Deeply affected myself by the injustice that I knew existed in Palestine, I visited the West Bank and Israel in January 2010, and I was deeply changed and affected by the injustice I saw. I wanted to, for myself, smash up the image of the Israel-Palestine conflict and see the reality with my own eyes. I went from being a media critic in my teenage years to now being a media maker in my early 20s. My attitude has been that if we can make alternative news content outside of the mainstream, and we should do it, which we definitely should, then I may as well try and do my share and get on with it now. For me, journalists should have passion. Newsmakers should be passionate for international law, human rights, justice, equality, and peace. I mean, as you know, in the mainstream, it's not easy to find passionate journalists. But I would challenge you not to disagree with me on the following. Journalists should be biased for human rights. I also believe that journalists should have a moral sensibility. Journalists should embody justice seeking and challenge. Journalists should seek to highlight and exceptionalize human suffering and injustice. After all, as Archbishop Desmond Tutu told us famously, If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. I first went to the Gaza Strip of Palestine in May last year, May 2012. And again, I was deeply impacted by the injustice that I saw there visited upon the Palestinians.
I'll leave it there. We're going to be talking to Harry Fear in the second hour. I just want to highlight that quote there from Desmond Tutu. If you remain neutral in a situation of conflict where there is a weaker and a stronger party, you are by default siding with the stronger party. And unfortunately, this is what so many of us are doing in our daily lives. And I've had many conversations with people about very important topics where people have said to me, look, I just haven't made my mind up. I don't know what I think about that. And many people argue to themselves that that is a fine and an honest and a noble position to take. They actually believe that that is a noble position to take. And the problem is that I do understand it when people feel they don't know enough to be able to make a decision. But when it is a situation of imminent danger or ongoing threat to people's lives, where it is actually resulting in death and destruction, you owe it to yourself to know what's going on. And this is where I find a lot of people don't sort of make the effort, because they'll say, well, I don't really know, therefore I won't have an opinion, I'll be neutral. But how hard do they try to find out? What sources do they go to? And you often find when people take this sort of stance, they haven't really done much thinking or reading. And indeed, thinking is as important as reading and gathering information, because you have to process it in your own mind. And several things of what Harry says there in the speech I just feel are so important about the necessity of journalists to have a moral compass and to be biased in favour of human rights. It's not just about some bland, blank slate objectivity. We're not robots, right? We're not just robots with cameras gathering information. We're here for a reason. It's the project, it's humanity, it's what we're all about. So do stay with us for the second hour. I'll be interviewing journalist and activist Harry Fear on his work in Gaza and the occupied territories in Palestine. Great interview coming up. Don't go away.